From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to 2014 and the January edition of the Bletchley Park podcast. This month we take you exclusively behind the scenes of the Bletchley Circle, finding out how they transported Bletchley Park back to not only 1943 but also 1953, with an attention to detail most of us can't imagine. As the series gets underway on ITV, we hear from a real Wren bomb operator who was told when she was recruited, "You must not mention this conversation to any living person." And years after the war, she was spotted by a fellow alumnus of Bletchley Park, and the secrecy they shared caused all sorts of suspicion about their relationship. We'll also let you in on plans for the fragile wooden huts being restored as part of the £8 million Heritage Lottery-funded restoration, with details of how their stories will be told. But first, Bletchley Park will come to life as never before when the Living History Project gets underway in February half-term. Actors will take on the roles of codebreakers and machine operators and will interact with visitors as though they too were working at the Government Code and Cipher School in February 1941. Liv Spencer is running the pilot project on behalf of the Bletchley Park Trust. I caught up with her during auditions. We're inside Cottage One in what might seem to be, at first glance, an unremarkable room. But this was one of many rooms around the site, which may look unremarkable now, but were used as part of the code-breaking office space back in World War II, which is a good example of how this place needs a bit of bringing back to life and nurturing. And that's exactly what the Living History Project aims to do, with actors playing roles and improvising, interacting with visitors. And Liv Spencer is leading that project for the Bletchley Park Trust and has been auditioning people today. Liv, how's it been going?
It's been great. So far, we've seen six people today and they've all been brilliant. They've all brought something different. They've all brought a slightly different point of view on the characters, and many of them have had their own personal relationship to Bletchley in terms of great aunts or grandmothers who are WAFs or all of that kind of thing.
That personal connection really makes it something tangible for them, doesn't it?
Exactly, yes. And interestingly, one of the ladies who had a great aunt who was here, she was like, "Well, my great aunt doesn't really talk about it that much. Even though I ask her, she doesn't talk about it." So it'd be nice for that lady to really have a reason to get into a really good conversation. So you've got to tell me this information
I
now.
I really need to know.
Exactly.
No excuses. Well, it's such an ingrained habit of secrecy.
They got,
as far as they knew, when they signed the Official Secrets Act, that was forever.
Yeah.
They didn't know that it would be lifted.
They were
deeply shocked, a lot of them, when it was. Those that do speak about it, even they, it took them a long time to get used to the idea that they could. So how easy or difficult do you think it was for these young actors that you've seen today, because the part you're casting for today is quite a young role, to really put themselves in the mindset of the people then in quite a different culture and quite a different time?
There have been some that have quite a lot of knowledge of Bletchley and who are quite interested in history, and then I think it's much easier to sort of step into it. What we're going to do with all of our actors is provide them with nice little bundles of research so that they can step into the characters that they need to. But I think those who are much more familiar with history of the period in general found it easier, definitely. But everybody's trained and is used to stepping into a character, and sometimes the character is right for you and sometimes it's not so right for you. So that's sometimes why people find it a little bit harder as well.
You're an actor and now you're casting actors.
Yes.
So maybe you're more sympathetic to the rigours of the audition process on the poor old battered ego. It must be really quite a big thing to put yourself through.
Well, it is, and as an actor, whatever the audition is for, I put all the preparation in, I've done all my research, I've practiced everything I need to practice, whatever, and you go for 50 auditions, maybe, and you get a very small percentage of those jobs, but you put all the work in. So I'm really aware that the people that are coming to audition for us are putting a lot of work in, and I'm really grateful that they are as well, because they're coming up with some really fantastic stuff and character traits that make the characters really interesting and complex. And that's only going to add to what we end up doing in the pilot.
Well, it's quite a big ask, isn't it? It's an unusual role. It's not just learn a script, occupy, inhabit a character, perform to an audience, perform to a camera. It's different than that, isn't it?
It's completely different. And a lot of people really thrive on doing that kind of interactive stuff. Because
it's quite fashionable now in sort of in teachings about drama and in performance, you know, things that are getting commissioned now.
I think it's getting more fashionable, yes. I think there's a lot of places are realising that theatre can happen outside of just the standard proscenium arch, velvet chairs, theatres, and actually a lot of that stuff is more exciting than the proscenium arch, you know, velvet chair theatre work, because you're in a different atmosphere and people are coming with a different expectation, and they're not thinking, oh, we'll just sit nicely and clap at the end. They want to get more involved. And so as an actor, every time you do one of these things, you never know quite what's going to happen, because it really depends on the audience or the visitors.
They're not just watching, they're part of it.
They're part of it if they want to be.
It's and some people make that distinction, yeah. Because some people would run a mile from that idea and feel as though the spotlight was on them and feel really uncomfortable. So it's part of what you're looking for is that sensitivity, isn't it?
Yes, that's exactly right. So, you know, what I sort of spot you come into the room, I sort of maybe start a conversation about the weather, realise that you don't really want to go there. So without you feeling like you've failed as an audience member, we just move on to whatever might be happening next and that kind of thing. So, yes, so some people might want to participate more and some people might want to participate too much, so the actors have to manage that a little bit as well because they've got a job to do. So it's sort of half your brain is being the character and half your brain is managing the situation.
Yeah, crowd control to a degree as well, because you don't want anyone to mug it, basically, and take over, either. And you've got to kind of hold them in your authority, in a way.
Absolutely, but you can't take control of them in a sort of negative way.
No.
It's a yes and, rather than a no but situation, if that makes sense. But I think whenever you have any kind of audience interaction, even if it's in a more traditional theatre setting, where you hand an apple, for example, to a member of the audience, you've got to be prepared for that apple to come back on the stage later in the play, in the death scene or whatever, because if you've asked your audience to join in, they can join in whenever they want and you've got to be prepared to deal with it. And a lot of people, you know, understand, okay, it's not appropriate to roll this apple now.
Oh, but there's the odd show off, isn't there? There's the odd, well, effectively hecklers.
Often the show offs and the hecklers make it all the more fun.
Yeah, it's how you deal with them,
exactly.
Isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
So you've had quite a lot to sift through in what you're looking for.
Yes.
In these auditions.
Yes.
Is that achievable in half an hour? Do you feel like you've come away with enough information about these people?
Yes, absolutely. We've spent a good chunk of the time doing what's called hot seating. So what I've been asking people to do is they come into the room and we have a little bit of a chat about the project. And then I ask them to leave, spend some time getting into character. Some of them have gone for a little wander around outside, come back, knock on the door and arrive as the character. We have a chat as the character and then they also leave as the character. So I get to see the whole sort of beginning, middle, end package. And I've got a sort of set of questions that I'm working my way through. But what I want to do is to encourage the actors to show different sides of the character. So the fun, light-hearted side and also the more vulnerable side.
And really getting them to think about life in the war, life at Bletchley Park and in that culture.
Exactly.
It's very immersive, isn't it?
Yes.
How did you come up with this idea in the first place?
Well, originally, over a year ago, I pitched an idea of doing a one-woman show about Barbara Abernethy, based in the morning room, where she actually worked. So that was her office, and the visitors would come in and meet her, etc. And for one reason or another, that didn't happen at the time. But then you guys here at Bletchley got in contact with me to come and talk about the possibility of doing a living history and how that might work. And my background is that I trained at East 15 Acting School, where they have a really strong living history. It's been going on for years and years, and we did 5 weeks every day, 8 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock at night, in character. And at the time, we were in the 1938 Russian gulags, so it was quite extreme, which obviously this won't be quite like that. This will probably be a bit gentler. So I kind of understand how effective that kind of stuff can be for an audience.
It must be a strange moment in your career as well to get to the point where you're now casting and directing other people. That's a transition from, that's a different thing than actually auditioning for those parts yourself and performing yourself.
It is. I've done quite a lot of directing, but on sort of short projects with, you know, teenagers and that kind of thing. And a lot of the work that I've done, because it's a lot of interactive, site-specific, the actors are part of the creative process. So the guys that come and work on this, you know, what you see will be them creating it, and I'll just be guiding and facilitating it. So I've been sort of just moving towards it, but having to sort of audition a lot of people for just four roles, it's really hard because I want to give everybody a job and it's not possible to do that. But hopefully this will be really successful and we'll do lots more of this kind of stuff, and then we'll have lots of opportunities for lots of local actors as well.
Two celebrated authors, Sinclair Mackay and Elisa Seagrave, will talk about how they researched and wrote their books, discussing the challenges they faced in decoding the once top-secret world of Bletchley Park, much of which is still not fully understood. Decoding Bletchley Park is on Saturday the 8th of March, and tickets are on sale now. This is a story about people. Those are the words of Alex Fitzsimmons from Event Communications, the company interpreting the buildings as part of the restoration project Neptune. She took us on a tour of Block C and then Hut 3, which with its partner Hut 6 is being delicately restored and brought back to life to allow visitors to experience what it was like inside for the codebreakers who worked there.
So I'm standing between where you used to come into Block C and being a dingy entrance hall into what we used to call the big room. It seems laughable now that we've called it the big room because it was about a tenth of the size of the cavernous space we stand in now. I'm very lucky to be joined by Alex Fitzsimmons from Event Communication, who are actually planning and working on the interpretation for all of these buildings, which is a huge task, isn't it, Alex?
Yeah, and it's been really exciting because I first started working here back in 2010 or something like that, and I remember coming into C Block and just looking at this vast sort of space. I think we were exploring with torches and dodging the pigeons and crumbly things you didn't quite know what they were.
Scratchy noises and
yeah,
the wind whistling through it. Was very dark and dank and creepy, actually.
Yeah,
and you can't imagine that now, really. We were commenting a little while ago, one of these spurs is going to be the shop, and because it's got windows around three sides of the four, it's ever so light and airy, even though it's a sort of a bunker type of a building.
Yeah, but you have
Are you
to
expecting
yeah.
that
no actually not that degree of light. I suppose the thing you have to remember is that in wartime you'd have had all the blackout curtains on after 4 p.m. or whatever time it got dark, so it would still have retained that slightly dark, probably a little bit depressing feel. But it is when the light comes in, it's amazing. People must have really enjoyed that, actually, as a working environment. That must have been great.
So can you describe to me what's going to be in here and how this is going to work?
What we decided to do with Block C was to make somewhere where people could really get the whole story of Bletchley Park. So it's the introduction to your visit, and it really is there to help you so you can explore the park and understand all the things there are to explore there. So two of these big spurs of Seabot will be exhibition. And the first one, we want people to feel like they're arriving in Bletchley Park. So as you would have arrived at Bletchley Park in wartime, then maybe you'd had to sign the Official Secrets Act. You arrived in this slightly strange place. People didn't quite know what was going to go on. They hadn't been told before they got here what their job would be.
Probably won't have a gun on the table. I'm a severe-looking officer, though, will we?
No, we won't have a gun on the table.
Leaving Block C behind us then, Alex, can you tell me what will happen as you come out there? So you'll have gone through the shop, you pay, you'll arrive, you can get coffee, you can have a comfort break, you can do all those practical things,
all
but also
things.
There's the overview exhibition, so you'll feel like you've stepped into Bletchley Park in the 1940s.
The main point is that you'll come out of Block C ready to explore the grounds of Bletchley Park. One thing that we're working on at this very moment, in fact, is a soundscape that's going to be throughout the park. So we're trying to record sounds which you might have heard in the 1940s, so that as you're walking around the grounds, you'll be able to hear perhaps a little bit of an overheard conversation or the sound of a train whistle, things that will really bring back that past. And we've drawn on veterans' memories a lot for this. So, for example, there are memories of playing rounders, playing tennis. There's an image we have of someone playing an accordion as they're ice skating on the lake. So we've tried to bring all of those things into that soundscape. And we're also putting some of that imagery out and about in the grounds so that you can see the old images where they were taken and really imagine yourself back.
Oh, lovely. So you'd be stepping back into wartime Bletchley.
Exactly.
So you never forget that you're somewhere remembering what happened here in that period.
Exactly. And huts 3 and 6 are very much part of that. Huts 3 and 6 are very interesting because there was a conservation management plan carried out at the beginning of working on this project, and they actually designated huts 3 and 6 as having the significance of artefacts, so they're just as important as any objects that survive from this period about this story, the buildings themselves, because such important things happened in them.
The care we take over our Enigma machines and our Typex machines, well, I say ours, they belong to GCHQ, yeah, and we look after them, we should be treating these buildings with that same respect and care and caution.
Which has led some of the way we've approached the interpretation, that it's very pared back. We're not putting a sort of exhibition in here. What we want is for people to imagine what it was like. And we've chosen a particular period, sort of the end of 1940, the beginning of 1941, when we sort of know approximately what was happening. Although you don't know exactly. At Bletchley Park, you never know exactly what was happening because everything was top secret and we're relying on veterans' memories and
you
the odd piece of documentation.
Against the other sometimes because you've got conflicting memories.
We're developing an approach which is about being open with visitors about that and saying when we don't know as much as when we do know. Mm. Because everyone who comes here is working out what that history was and we are giving them the tools to do that.
Just approaching huts 3 and 6, can you give me an idea of what this is going to be like?
Well, again, when I first saw them, they were in quite some disrepair. And it's great to see them being looked after now. Looked after is the word, because one thing that the architects have been working very hard on is repairing these in a way that doesn't make them look just like new, because these were buildings which were put up very quickly in the war and very economically.
So we're at the doorway.
You come into this corridor.
This building was a hub, wasn't it? Really important stuff happened to you. Decisions about how the messages would be sent out, you know, which ones would go, where they would go.
So yes, in huts 3 and 6 together had some very important functions. As you look into all these little separate rooms, that's an important Bletchley Park story, because people in one room didn't necessarily know what was happening in the next room, because it was all different, separate, secret tasks.
Like a little beehive.
Yeah. And what's going to happen in here is we're going to create theatre in here. We're recording a sort of a radio play that you'll hear based on things that might have happened during the war in this hut. Conversations about the work people are doing, conversations about the gossip around the hut, because you were much more allowed to talk about gossip than you were about the work that you were doing. Conversations about whether the heating was working, because it was pretty cold if it wasn't in winter.
Well, not much has changed around here. Although now we are more encouraged to talk about work than gossip.
That's true. But alongside that, we're going to project some images showing people in the hut, so you'll get the faintest of inklings that there were people here, with the voices, the odd image, and props, sort of light set dressing. So nothing that is permanent and couldn't just be taken out of the hut, because the hut is what we're exhibiting, and what we're doing is we're trying to show off this hut in a way that allows people to imagine what it was like in the war. So you really will be able to walk through here and imagine the people who worked here and feel a bit like you've met them.
So it quite sounds almost ghostly.
Almost
really nice
ghostly.
Way.
Yes, it should be. It should really be about imagining atmosphere. It's certainly not about here's lots of information about hut 6 and 3, and that's only partly because there isn't lots of detailed information with facts. It's because this is a story about people and what their lives were like, and we want people to be able to imagine that.
And so back to the Bletchley Circle. The cast and crew were full of enthusiasm about filming scenes in the second series here at the home of the Codebreakers. We poked about behind the scenes exclusively and can now bring you an insight into how the illusion of wartime Bletchley and the teacher training college 10 years later was created. The production crew were keen as mustard on authenticity wherever possible, so were allowed to use wartime machines, which we look after on behalf of GCHQ. Only Bletchley Park staff were allowed to handle some of those machines, so we cropped up in the first episode, the scene set in the machine hut in 1943.
take a year to crack this from scratch. Anything in clear at all?
Still nothing. Look, it's not our end. The only explanation is the Germans have changed their machines.
If they've changed their machines, we may as well all give up and go home. God knows we could use this to sleep.
It's been 2 days. In Hut 4, I've got girls sitting twiddling their thumbs waiting for decrypts. They're getting very twitchy up at the house.
Let's go back to a data set from last week, run that, see what we get. At least then we can eliminate...
Wait! I think I've got it.
What?
They haven't changed the machines. They changed the code. Does anybody else count the letters in the message header?
Why would anyone do that?
The message header is 3 characters longer than it used to be. I think they've changed their encoding system. Move the 3 indicator characters out of the code and into the message header.
To what purpose?
It's easier for the operators that way. They've been using the system for 2 years now and I think it's unbreakable.
They're getting sloppy.
Those 3 characters are throwing everything off. We just need to...
It can't be that simple.
Why not? You can build the most perfectly complicated machine in the world, but it'll still be run by people. People love shortcuts.
Try it, please. Clear now.
Yeah.
You sure you shouldn't be working in Hut 4?
Oh, I don't know. I've got some machines, really.
Well, if you ever change your mind.
Right. Nicely done, Miss Murr. Will you come up to the house, will you? Carry on, everyone, please.
So I'm with Emily Shepherd, apprentice extraordinaire, and our director of learning and collections, Vicky Walpole. Now, you two, with me, were in the second series of the Bletchley Circle. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit about what you had to do and why?
Well, we had to act as extras for the Bletchley Circle.
Yeah, they don't call them extras anymore.
No, we were SAs. Yes. And the reason for that was that a lot of Bletchley Park equipment was used during the filming, which only Bletchley Park employees are allowed to touch. So as part of that, we had to be clothed and made up. To look
or not made up more as it was.
Yes, or have our makeup taken off.
Yeah.
To look very 1940s, which for me included wearing a lovely red-haired wig. And for Eloise, I believe, what happened to you?
I received a brown wig with grey streaks in it. Everyone wondered whether it was my actual hair.
You should point out Eloise is merely 19 years old, so a bit of grey hair put you forward a few years, didn't it? But yours was a spectacular ginger wig, and you're normally blonde, yes. Very blonde. Well, Eloise's hair is dip dyed, which is very fashionable right now, but I don't think anybody would have done that in the 40s. But mine, they rolled it up and put it up, and I looked like my grandma, basically. And the dress didn't help. I don't know, it surprised me. I thought we were going to be military, and we weren't.
I actually liked my outfit.
I liked mine too.
Eloise looked like she'd just walked out of H&M. In hers. It was very modern, I thought.
I thought it was super flattering
on
as well.
On Eloise, yes.
Well, fashion comes round and round, doesn't it? So maybe quite a lot of... I've seen some of what they're wearing today. I've noticed a few pairs of shoes that I thought wouldn't look out of place now. Quite broguish and very fashionable.
Yeah, definitely.
It was fun, but what surprised me was how much there is of... It reminded me of being at school. It's very much sit still, be quiet, don't move, you know, and do the same thing over and over and over again.
It was definitely an experience being an SA. Purely the number of takes they do of the same thing, I think, over and over. I don't think I want it to be my job full time. But it was a brilliant experience to be part of the whole dressed set, which looked wonderful, didn't it? And seeing our machines in a set that looked realistic for the time, albeit dramatic interpretation of that.
It was lovely fake smoke and all the lighting. It was very atmospheric, wasn't it?
Yes.
Wish we could dress the museum like that all the time.
Yeah.
It did look great.
It was great to be part of something where we saw how the huts may end up looking, that sort of atmospheric feeling. And I'm hoping that when we finish with huts 3 and 6, you'll get that evocative sense of how it felt to be in the 1940s.
In a way, acting, you're playing, aren't you, for a living? That plays it down, really, doesn't it? Any actor would be horrified to hear me say that. But you're imagining yourself in the situation, and it really was quite powerful to imagine yourself at Bletchley Park in wartime with that incredible sense of purpose and need. And, you know, most of them would have been about Eloise's age, really.
It's not a job. We might be a little bit too old. I definitely would be a little bit too old to be here during the war.
And I look it in the programme, I look like my grandma. But never mind. It was good fun. It'll be more fun, I think, for my friends and family to see me on that than it will for me. Although my sister saw us still and she said, "Don't worry, no one will know that's you."
Nobody will recognise me in a million years.
Oh no, the ginger
wig. That wig.
Which is good.
We're on the second day of Bletchley Circle filming the second series. Now, this is a very complicated one, so I've pulled the producer, Trevor Hopkins, to one side to explain to me how it all works.
Today, we're filming the last two episodes. Altogether, we're filming 4 episodes for the new series, which will be on your screens early next year. There are 2 separate stories spanning the original Bletchley girls here in 1943 and 1953. I can't tell you totally what the plot is, but the first one involves a government conspiracy and poison gas. Ooh. And the second one is a story of black market and West End Maltese gangs and sex trafficking of women in the 1950s.
I gather you've shot largely on location for this series, so you must have places sort of rushing before your eyes.
Yes, but there's nothing like Bletchley Park to help focus this entire series into what it is. And this time around we're spending more and more on the outside of Bletchley, whereas on the previous film we've spent quite a bit of time indoors recreating the actual Enigma machines and everything else that happened there, the bomb, which has been a very exciting time.
If you know you're Bletchley, you'd have recognised that the first time around. But now, there's much more to show the casual viewer, if you like, the main... Just have about heard of Bletchley Park, that this is really Bletchley Park and you're filming it here.
Yeah, this is Bletchley Park, and Bletchley Park keeps changing every time we come because there's a lot of restoration going on here with many of the huts, and I think it makes a fantastic visit. It's really exciting. And recently we were here filming at night, and you get a very strong sense of what it must have been like here in 1943, during the war, the camaraderie, the mystery, the excitement, the hard work. It's a wonderful place, full of memories. I didn't know very much about Bletchley myself until I started working on this project and reading up about it. And since that point in time, I've just been to see a play about Bletchley, which is upcoming and very good and uses past memories and talks about the people that actually saved Bletchley from its near destruction, which I had no idea about.
Well, we're delighted to have you here and I cannot wait to see the finished product.
And I think you're in it, aren't you?
Yes, apparently so. A bit more than I intended. I thought it would just be my hands on a machine, but no, some full face going on. I look like my grandmother, but we'll try not to dwell on that.
Well, we hope to do many more to come here and keep speaking to you about them.
All right. Here we got it. Turn over, every camera.
Sound speed. Mark, please, around sound.
Okay. 572, take 3, A camera mark.
On
board B camera.
Okay. Camera action. Action, ladies.
Cut.
We cut, thank you.
So, with Tom Knight, now you're standby art director. What does that mean exactly?
That's correct. It means I am the art department representative with the camera and the actors and the director. So, all the hard legwork is done by my fabulous team behind me in preparation for when the camera arrives, and then I turn up with the camera and make sure that everything is dressed properly and looking pretty and nice.
So they must fear your arrival then?
Well, I think they kind of look forward to my arrival because it means they can wash their hands of it and move on to the next
one.
Because the art department always are working in front of the camera in preparation, really silently working away ahead of everything, making sure everything's right before the camera turn up and it all goes ahead.
You've covered up some of our slightly older signs, which I have to say your version looks better than what we've got.
Oh really? Well, I'm sure if you spoke to our graphic designer Andy, he might even let you hold on to them if you wish. But I'm not sure they make any sense in the modern day.
Well, no, they direct people to different parts of Bletchley Park College, and we did have some discussions about what they would cover those signs with. So, well, in 1953, which is what you're creating at the moment,
yeah.
And that noise you can hear is someone covering up the yellow lines.
That is our standby prop, Dave. Wherever we go on a period piece, we carry rolls and rolls of asphalt. So they didn't have yellow lines back in 1953, or generally road markings. And so every exterior scene where there's a road, we have to make sure that they're covered up, or kindly ask the camera operator to frame it out of shot if we haven't got the asphalt on board. And it's those little things that you often don't think about unless you work in the art department, the attention to detail, that, you know, when we cover it up you don't notice it, but if we didn't it would be glaringly obvious and it would ruin the whole look of the shot, because it would detract from the drama and what the storyline is, and all people are looking at is, oh, look at that yellow line. Why is that there? Yeah.
I think it's fascinating to think of what you see when you look at something compared to what I see when I look at something. It must be completely different.
Well, in terms of the potential that we look at a space, an interior or exterior, yeah, maybe. I don't know. I couldn't tell you. I don't think we see differently, but in terms of, you know, I see a building as much as you do, but yeah,
you when see we walk light into when,
yeah,
things when, you've got to cover
that
up.
Is even when I'm walking around modern day life, when I'm not working, if I see,
can't switch it off.
Yeah, if I see certain light switches and things, and things that shouldn't be there, when I'm working on a period drama, all I'm thinking is, God, I'd have to cover that up.
It must be exhausting.
Yeah.
You were involved with the first block where we dressed inside Block B.
Yes, that was a big set for us. Yeah,
it was
originally your museum, and we came in and changed it quite dramatically. With a lot of help, I have to say, from you guys. You really helped us out with exactly how the Enigmas would look and be operated, and the Type X machines and the bomb decoding machines. And we tried to make a feature of all that because it adds great production value having all of the machinery that they would have used in the war effort.
And some slightly strange looking creatures operating them, because we had to handle our own machines.
Yeah.
So that's one of the conditions of the loan we have with them, that's how we have to look after them. And it's fair enough, they are unique historic artifacts.
Yeah, definitely. It's probably a good idea, with otherwise it'll be me handling it, and I'm very clumsy and probably break the historical value.
I've heard a little bit inside track on this, is you're going to have to make an Enigma machine, because there's some taking apart of a machine, which we couldn't let you do with the real one.
No, well, there is in the script a scene where one of the characters in the story starts to fiddle around and fix an old machine. And we are in the process, I believe, of constructing our own, sort of. You know, it won't be fully functioning, but it's just great that we can have such detailed access to, like, all those machinery. We can replicate ours quite accurately, hopefully. So.
Well, it's a great showcase for Bletchley Park. The first series I found really powerful in the focus it gave people on the secrecy and how they had to carry that with them for so long after the war. So people think about the secrecy during the war, they don't think about the next 30 years.
No.
These people went into lives and nobody around them knew what they'd done or how important it was. It really focused on that, and a drama can do a much better job of that than a documentary, I think.
It can do. Well, you can tell the stories behind, you know, family life that you can illustrate.
So obviously you get involved with the characters.
Yeah, you become attached in a way to those people, and the stories and the background history to what they do, as well as the work that they've done in the war. It's, you know, what they do afterwards. And these women, we tried to portray that these women, you know, in the war, they were helping save potentially millions of lives, and then all of a sudden they're back being just general 1950s housewives doing not very important work, basically just housework and secretarial work, and they're brilliant minds. And I think that's what they're trying to show, that they can still use their brilliance to solve crime mysteries.
Yeah. So give us an idea of the career path of a standby art director. How did you end up doing this?
I originally worked in production, straight out of school, becoming a runner, and I worked in production for 7 years, but decided it wasn't for me in the end. But so I went and retrained in art direction, and that was at Pinewood Studios. And I think a good base level for an art director is to have technical drawing skills. So my background is in technical drawing, so for construction, it's kind of architectural drawings, really. And then from there, you kind of get onto the floor, which is what I'm doing now. So those are the kind of the stepping stones, and then from here I move up into, you know, the lofty heights of design. You know, being on the floor is a great experience, and it gives you an insight to exactly what would be seen and how things work on camera, because you can envisage lots of things offset, but when you come to it you may only see a very, very small amount of what the amount of work that's actually been done behind the scenes. And then it's good to know what you need to do instead of having to do everything and then just not use it all. I've worked on a couple of films, nothing big, but yeah, I did a Sally Potter film earlier last year called Ginger and Rosa. That was another period piece set in early 60s, that was good. And my only other period piece is this. It's nice, it makes a nice change from modern day stuff, although there's a bit more work involved with all the cover-ups. But
authenticity.
Yeah, it's also nice because the research that you have to do to get the period looking correct is much more in depth, I think, than a modern day drama. And that's one of the best things about being in the art department, is that you get to research and learn about, every job is different, and you get to learn and research about lots of different things that you wouldn't necessarily do in a normal job. You wouldn't get the access or the need to go and, you know, look at Typex machines and Enigma machines and
find out
how it all works. Yeah, yeah. You know, most people wouldn't really learn anything about Bletchley Park outside of GCSE school history.
Mm. But
And maths.
Maths.
Well, I didn't study maths at A-level. When we're in the preparation stage of the production, we churn out tons and tons and tons of imagery and research and plaster it all over our walls in the art department. Our art department is just a massive collage of imagery and reference from the period to kind of build a real feel to our project. It's a good department to work in.
You must get sort of completely immersed in each thing.
You do. Yeah, you do. It's kind of
a strange thing because you don't stay on one thing for very long.
No, that's just filming. You're completely consumed for 2 or 3 months on a project. You don't really have any time for life or anything else.
A year later, couldn't tell anyone anything about it.
Yeah, that's it.
Because you're on to the next thing.
Yeah, but it's the worst thing and the best thing about what we do, I suppose.
Imagine being told you must not mention this conversation to any living person and having to stick to it, as far as you know, for the rest of your life. This was the reality for all those sent to Bletchley Park and its outstations, including Wren bomb operator Audrey Wind, who was plucked from filthy cleaning jobs during basic training and assigned to a very, very secret job. She tells her story in a DVD extra on the second series of The Bletchley Circle. I caught up with her during filming. So first, let's talk about how you were recruited. Can you tell me about that?
Well, I had to join up in the summer of 1944, towards the end of the war. I was called up in early August, just before I became 19, later in the month, at the end of the month. And the Wrens was the only one of the three women's services that had a pre-service training. The other people went straight in. We didn't. We had a pre-service training of a fortnight, and during that time, if they didn't like the look of us, they would tell us to go home, and we'd immediately be called up for the Land Army or some ATS or something else. And some people were sent home. It wasn't a myth.
So you'd chosen the Wrens, wanting to be in
the Wrens. I wanted to be in the Wrens, yes. I had a great family connection with the Wrens. I had a cousin who was commander on HMS Formidable, and my great-grandfather was captain of the ship that brought Prince over to marry Queen Victoria. Great-great-grandfather, I think it was. And so we have a family connection with the Navy, always have had, and I wanted to go in the Wrens. My sister served in the WAF, but I wanted to go in the Wrens. Anyway, I was called up and asked to report up to Tallyhewin Castle in Scotland. At that time in the war, there was so much bombing in London, it was so dreadful, that they had stopped using the London base for people who were called up. There were other bases too. And I went up to Tallyhewin and got there, and it was a lovely castle up on the hill, but that was the Holy of Holies where the officers lived. And we were down in Nissen huts down below, and I was allotted a bed and or a bunk and so on. And during the fortnight we were there, we weren't aware of it, but we were obviously being very closely watched. I was told afterwards, because the officer who recruited me, I became great friends with her later on. I met her at various events, and I used to go up to London to meet her, and lovely person. She died some years after war. And so during the second week I was at Tullyhewan, six of us were told to report up to the castle, which was, as I say, the Holy of Holies, and we thought, my goodness, what have we done wrong? And they put us through our paces, they gave us filthy cleaning jobs to do and that sort of thing, just to see what we were made of, really. I didn't mind, because I thought, I'll do anything, you know, and I got stuck into anything. But as I say, half a dozen of us were told to report up to the castle. We thought we hadn't cleaned something properly or we were in trouble. We were told to line up in alphabetical order. And one by one, we were taken. The first one was called into the room. We didn't know where. We hadn't been in anywhere up there before. And when she came out, we said, you know, what's it all about? And she just walked straight past us and out the door. And this happened with each one until it got to my turn, and I was the next to last. And poor old Pro-Ren Wright, who had to be left on her own, I said, don't worry, I'll tell you whatever it is. So I walked into the room, and to my amazement and rather, well, horror really, there was a long, very long oak table. Behind it, in the middle, was a Wren officer. This Wren officer, I said, I later got to know very well. And there were various other officers of different forces and one or two civilians. And they sat there, and I went up and saluted the officer, and she told me to stand at ease. And she talked to me for a little while, and then she said, well, we want you to do something which is very, very secret, but we can't tell you what it is. But when you leave this room, you mustn't mention this conversation to any living person. Is that understood? Yes, ma'am, it is understood. And she said, is anything you want to say? And I said, no, thank you, ma'am, and saluted and about turned and went out of the door, of course, right past poor Pro-Ren Wright, who soon found out. Well, she didn't find out, because none of us did. And we were very quickly removed. We didn't complete the second week.
Now, sometime after you were demobbed, you found yourself working in a school.
Well, I did a year at college, and it was a very good college, and we didn't just do shorthand and typing. We did all sorts of things. And I completed that year of training, and I saw a job advertised as secretary at the Harvey Grammar School at Folkestone, which is a very celebrated, very good grammar school, founded in 1674 by money left in the will of William Harvey, the doctor, who was a GP in Folkestone, his nephew, Sir Eliab Harvey, who was his heir. He used a lot of the money that William Harvey left to found the Harvey Grammar School. So in 1674 it was founded and had different premises, but it finally was along Chariton Road, where it still is. And I applied for this job and got an interview, and they'd had an enormous, in those days they did enormous number of applications, 80-odd I think. So I was very, very lucky, and I got the job. And the strange thing was that I obviously, it was still absolutely, we were sworn to secrecy. We didn't expect it ever to come out. I worked very happily and closely with Oliver Berto, who actually was well known at Bletchley Park, but I didn't know that, and I worked very happily with him. We seemed to blend in an extraordinary way. We knew what the other one was thinking almost, and we worked very closely together, filling in these terrific forms we had to do for the education people and so on. And we did work extremely well together. And he was apparently, I didn't know, fascinated about this. He felt the same. And he had a suspicion that perhaps I had worked for Bletchley Park because of the way my mind worked, I suppose. And one Easter holidays, when we were alone in the school, he suddenly looked across at me and said, "Audrey, where were you stationed in the war?" And I thought, oh, it won't mean anything to him. So I said, "Oh, Eastcote." And he nearly fell off his chair. And he put his head in his hands, and I always remember, and then he looked across and, well, he said, "I'll just make sure the caretaker isn't around. He's the only one who comes into the school in the school holiday." So he had a look and he wasn't around. So he came back in the room and he said, "Now, I think it's wise if I test you and you test me, think up something that I couldn't answer if I hadn't worked for Bletchley Park, and I'll do the same. And it's my regret to this day that I can't remember what he tested me with and what I tested him with. It was difficult to think of something. We both had a thought for a while, then we each came up with something. And I tested him and he passed. He tested me and I passed. And so that was all right. And so then we made sure the school was empty and we had a good old natter about it. It was wonderful relief to me to be able to talk to somebody about it."
So you had a good natter with it. Was that the only time you talked about it, or did it become sort of you'd be...
Well, no, we had to be awfully careful. When the school was there, we wouldn't have dreamt of doing so. Once or twice in the holidays, we said an odd thing. There was one occasion when, I think it was in any Easter holidays, there were one or two people working in the school, and he wanted to talk about something. He'd heard about something and he wanted to tell me. And so we came out of the school and we walked down Cherry Garden Avenue, which is just near the school, just a little way down, and there was nobody about. It was always very quiet there. And he told me, and we talked a little bit about it, and we came back into the school. Somebody from the school apparently went past in a car and saw us going down there and started up a rumour that we were having an affair, which we certainly weren't.
I must say, you can forgive them for thinking that. There you were having an obviously secret conversation.
Well, I suppose so. And why would we come out of the school? But yeah, there was a very good reason for
all
it.
All have ears. Mm. Well, like you say, there were a lot of people working as part of the Bletchley Park operation, spread around the country, like yourself, at the outstations, you know, 1,000 wrens and more at Eastcote alone. And we don't actually have accurate figures of how many altogether. So the way that people must have been scattered across the country, it is quite odd to find two working together.
Well, it wasn't two, it was three. Because on this occasion, when he found out that I was there and I found out he was at Bletchley Park, he said to me, "Well, Johnny Gilbertson was also there. He was our head of German in the school." It was extraordinary, three in one school. And a day or two later, Johnny Gilbertson knocked on the door of my office and came in, and he just put his head round the door and he said, "I hear you were one of us." And I said, "Yes." And that's the only thing we ever said.
It must have been like being in a little club. You must have had an understanding with each other.
Even to this day, I feel a bit like that. Yes, I think we all do.
And of course, then some years after that, The Secret actually came out in 1974. What was that like for you?
Well, my father was a rather Victorian, stern sort of gent. Very nice, but I mean, you know, that was the way they were in those days. And he used to ask me occasionally something about the war, and I wouldn't say anything. And he used to say, "But you can tell your father." I can hear him saying it now. And I said, "No, father, I can't." And he was very huffy about it. And this particular morning, I'd taken my mother's breakfast up, as I did every morning, to give it to her in bed on a tray, and given my father his breakfast in the dining room, and the paper came, and I picked it up. And on the front page was a piece to say that this secret had come out about Bletchley Park, what it did. And I was a sort of mixture of being appalled and being pleased that I could now tell my parents. So I went in and I said, "Father, I can tell you now what I did in the war." And he was very huffy. He wasn't going to unbend much, but he did soon start to take an interest, and he was very interested. I went up with the paper. My mother always used to have the paper up in bed first of all, and my father's sight was getting bad then, so he couldn't read so well. And I gave her the newspaper in bed, went up to collect her tray before I went off to school, and I said, "Mother, I can tell you now what I did during the war. It was code breaking." She said, "Oh," picked up the paper and started to read. Talk about squashed.
What an anticlimax. After all those years, keeping that secret faithfully.
It was. I think it's quite funny now. I think I was a little bit hurt at the time.
I bet you were.
But they were Victorian people. They were. My parents were old when I was born. They were 40 and 41. And they were born in 1884 and 1885. So it's going back a long way, and it's a different sort of attitude, you know.
We express ourselves differently now, yes. Don't we? So looking back on the secrecy, do you feel like you were sort of part of a secret society almost?
It was absolutely imperative that we all kept the secret. Absolutely imperative. And nobody gave it away, I'm absolutely sure of that. And I've met so many women whose husbands weren't told that I really don't think anybody could have talked about it. I don't know, you can't say that, but I think on the whole, if not everybody, and certainly pretty well everybody, didn't tell their nearest and dearest, I'm sure of it.
And to have been involved in something that required such specific talents and aptitudes, and to have been so hugely important, I think everybody's war work, especially if they were young when they did it, defined them for some years.
Yes, I think it did. Yes.
It must have been hard because you weren't able to tell people what you did in your war because everybody had their war.
Yes, I think you're right. Yes, people, they talk about Bletchley Park. Oh, you were at Bletchley Park. And if I say I wasn't, they think that, oh, you weren't probably, you know, you, doesn't matter about you, you weren't
in it. You just made the tea.
You weren't in it, yes, yeah. You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas, actually, and as I say, Bletchley Park moved to Eastcote for 6 years, I think it was there, before it moved down to Cheltenham.
Well, thank you for sharing all that. That was wonderful.
MC Fontaine here with a quick message for you. Just before Christmas, we passed 100,000 downloads, so we wanted to take this opportunity just to say thank you to you, our listeners. That wouldn't have been possible without Audio Boo, who hosts the podcast for us. And Amanda Brown, the head of content at Audio Boo, told me why they do it.
We strongly believe in the power of audio to educate, entertain and share stories. The Bletchley Park podcast is a fantastic example of all these things, sharing the fascinating stories this historic site has to offer and consistently delivering informative, engaging content to the Audio Boo community. We're delighted to support the podcast and look forward to working with Bletchley Park on future projects.
So as always, thanks to Audio Boo, and I'll pass you back to Catherine for the rest of the thank yous.
Thanks to the staff, volunteers and veterans of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk or find us on iTunes. Also, follow us on Twitter, where we are at @bparkpodcast, and join our Facebook group. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.